Sorry, I just got distracted by it.
Aha!
I got a Slack message from my work Slack about me doing a good job, and it...
That was probably an error. I think that was supposed to come to me.
You don't work with me except on this podcast, Scott, and you do a good job.
And they probably know that.
They don't. They definitely don't.
Read the message, Jamie. I'm pretty sure it says, hey, please pass along to Scott that we thought the latest episode was very well put together.
The message says, Robin of Culinary Conservatory says, Jamie, would you please tell Scott that his production and dulcet tones make me smile.
That's the only part that's going into the episode. Thank you very much, Robin. That's so kind. That's so thoughtful. Welcome.
Wow, you stole the words right out of my mouth.
I stole it. What? I'm doing it this time. I said it first.
Sure, go on ahead.
No, that was it. I just wanted to say welcome first.
Welcome!
That was really loud. That hurt my ears a little bit.
Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you who don't know shit about one or the other topic, my name is Jamie Harrison Rubin. I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott. You don't need my middle or last name. I'm the movie guy, and we are here to help you, dear audience. Each episode, James and I pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
Hold on. Are you abandoning the your movie guy thing?
I just forgot.
You're not their movie guy anymore?
I'm struggling today, okay? I'm struggling.
Scotty don't have his meds today.
We're doing a two-parter, if everyone must know. I'm sure I've said it before. I have diagnosed ADHD, mm-hmm. and because of certain problems in the front-end administration of my doctor's office, I am without script at the moment. And this is not going to go well.
I think it's going to go great.
Well, it's already a disaster. Please proceed.
Anyway, we tell you why we like these movies and wines, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. We almost never do. Today is part two of our mini-series, A Philadelphia Tasting Menu.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point.
Jamie added the exclamation point.
We have to have exclamation points so that I know to be enthusiastic.
All right, but the first episode in this miniseries dropped today, and you wrote the copy that is for it, and you did not put an exclamation point.
That's true. I didn't. I didn't do it.
Yeah. Oh, well. Nor was it in the little bit of press that we got.
No exclamation point.
I mean, I feel like that press would have been even better for us. It was very nice press, though.
It was
very exciting.
Shout out to Maddie. Thank you, Maddie.
Shout out to Maddie. Shout out to Philly Mag for including us on their list of six.
The most exciting
Philly food events that you can enjoy this summer. And one of the most exciting food events that you can do is listen to this show. It's pretty great.
Yeah. It makes me feel good. It makes Scotty feel good. And if you like making me and Scott feel good, then that should make you feel good.
Yeah. I mean, in the realm, if you're going to talk about feeling good, like I don't normally, but I sat on it for a day. I didn't make comment when I shared this on the social media, not to correct the author or the publication, but I am not a local film pro. I am a semi-local former movie professional.
Yes.
And now I am just a person who has seen a number of movies and can talk about them with some level of education.
Your professional expertise doesn't leave you when you step out of a job.
But I am no longer a professional.
I'm
no longer a professional.
But if you were to throw your hat in the ring for a new position, they would be considering you as a professional.
Yes.
Not, they wouldn't be considering like to make you a professional. They would be considering your professional acumen, which you still have.
Yeah. All right. I'll take it. Never mind. I no longer need to pick that nit.
There you go.
And to be clear, I'm not nitpicking the writing. Just
being self-deprecating for no reason.
Well, I have trouble with anything nice said about me. I struggle with it.
Scotty, I like you,
it
and
doesn't
I think
feel apt.
That
this
you are
is not
very
sincere.
Smart.
I'm fine with this because this is just bullshit.
Oh man. Anyway, we talk so much about food on this show, and apparently, I don't give Scott pairing suggestions in advance of our recordings. That I thought maybe we should talk about the thing that's supposed to go with wine, which is food. So I put together a list of some of my favorite Philadelphia restaurants and contacted the owners to see what dishes they wanted to showcase.
And on the I like this wine. This is yums.
It's a yummy one.
Jamie's 2 for 2 this miniseries so far, everybody, which is a far cry from last miniseries when he was 2 for 6 with me. Yeah, already off to the right. This is not going well. I need my script. This is a problem. This my is brain a, is in eight directions at once.
It's a good wine.
It's numbers.
It is Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir. And on the movie side of things, I picked six movies that in one way or another explore the power of food. Specifically, I was looking for things about meals that are shared. And I want to reiterate, as I will every single episode at least a few times, I'm pairing to the wine. The Venn diagram is Jamie picked a food. Then, immediately to the left of that, there is another circle that overlaps with food circle, and that is wine. Then, immediately to the, I guess, left of that, there is another circle that is movie that overlaps with wine, but does not even come adjacent to the food.
That's correct.
I am not pairing to the meal. I do not want to be judged on that metric, nor do I feel that the restaurant should feel in any way judged by my movie selections, that this has nothing to do with that. But I still wanted to do something food related because you're doing a food thing.
Right. And yeah. I like food.
I like a little bit of a, like a, some kind of thematic linkage.
Some kind of a through line somewhere.
It would just be strange if I just had a totally different thing that had no connection at all.
We've done that before, but I like doing like a thing.
You've done that before. I've never done that before.
I guess that's true. Yeah. You've always tried to link them together.
Jamie's History of American Wine. I picked all American movies.
You did. You did.
Matrix, your entire thematic through line for all the Pinot's Gris just reminded me of Matrix. And so we
that's
found.
Just because you became obsessed with.
I didn't railroad it, though. I found parallels in the narrative that you wanted to weave about Pinot Grigio.
Sure.
I did.
Okay.
And if anyone wants to go back and listen to that 18-hour miniseries, they might agree.
That was a fun miniseries. I enjoyed doing it.
I feel as though that is the creative peak of the show thus far. We've released better episodes before and since.
Yes.
But I feel like there's some specialness in that.
There really is.
And I wish more people listened to those episodes.
I agree. Hopefully in the future they will. For our second dish of this miniseries, I contacted Michael Ferreri of Irwin's Upstairs in the Bach Building in Philadelphia. It's a Sicilian restaurant focused on producing classics of the region as well as some fun but simple twists. The style is straightforward and based around getting the highest quality local ingredients possible, aside from a few choice Italian imports like oils and preserved things. Michael is greatly influenced by his family, and this dish is emblematic of that. We had the other night, gnocchi sardi with eggplant and chilies, based upon his grandmother's recipe.
We actually had quite a bit more than that.
We did. We had a whole dinner at Irwin's.
Jamie got all defensive because he was like, I'll order for everyone, which is the classic Jamie thing to do. And I called him. I'm like, hey, now, don't do that thing that you like to do where you order way too fucking much for all of us. And then I'm like super logy and have to cry when we're leaving the restaurant because I can't make decisions because my tummy is so full. And you were like, I'm going to order a reasonable number. And then you repeated all the things that you said you were going to order before I called you out, but you added two dishes to
That's correct, yes.
And then the server came over. What was her name? She was terrific.
Celia.
Celia came over to take the order, and she's like, oh, Jamie, I forgot. There's also a special. And you're like, we'll have that as well.
That wasn't as well. That was a replacement for the second pasta that I was intending on ordering.
And which one was
that?
Because
it was a pasta special.
The special was the thing with the braised rabbit?
The fazoletti with braised rabbit, yes.
Oh, that was
and
dope.
And heirloom tomatoes.
That was mega dope.
Gorgeous.
I want more of that. I just like rabbit.
Yep.
I like the gaminess.
Yep.
And the, you know.
It's like, what if chicken, but had more interest and more intrigue?
Yeah.
I like it a lot. So we also had gnocchi sardi with eggplant and chilies. And the wine I chose to accompany that dish comes to us from Patagonia, Argentina. These are some of the southernmost vineyards in the world. This is from Bodega Chakra. This is their Barda bottling of Pinot Noir 2020, available at Crush Wine Company for $26.
Well, Jim Jam, you told me that this wine was friendly, warm, historic, velvety or plush, and floral, parentheses, roses. To which I paired Sofia Coppola's 2006 Marie Antoinette. As of this recording, you can watch Marie Antoinette on Hulu or wherever it is you get your VODs. And I guess now is a good time for me to confess that prior to selecting it for this miniseries, I had never seen Marie Antoinette before.
Well, Good blind pick. I really enjoyed my watching experience.
I don't really care about that. It had been on my Letterboxd watch list for...
It's not nice. You're just not a nice person.
Multiple years. And like sometimes it would not be on any of the streams and that's why I wouldn't watch it. And then sometimes it would be. And I just like, I always struggle to pick a thing to watch. And then this, you know, food and the descriptors you gave me and it gave me an excuse to watch something I've wanted to watch for a long time. And oh man, that is a good movie. I love it.
Lots of food.
Oh my God, so much food.
A lot of food.
So much food. And the towers, too. That was Tani's big takeaway after we watched it. She's like, I think food towers should come back. Do you have a favorite food tower in Marie Antoinette?
It was one of the scenes where they're sitting down next to each other for breakfast. Yeah. There is like a baked, like pastry, like spire situation. That clearly has like some kind of a meat inside of it, but it's like it's pointy and castle-y and like, and it's just between them. And what I wanted was for one of them to just break some of it off and eat it like a lollipop.
Yeah,
but that didn't happen.
I think my favorite, and I was surprised by this, was there was one where many of the pillars were made of asparagus.
Mm.
There was like an asparagus and greens and like, I think like broccoli crowns or something on top, like this beautiful bit of like greens architecture. But also there was one that was like some kind of unholy chimera of lobster and crabs.
Oh God, yes.
With just like claws all over that looked amazing. And
apologies
also
to anyone out there with shellfish allergies. Frightening.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't watch Marie Antoinette. Also, if you're diabetic, you definitely cannot watch Marie Antoinette.
It's true.
You will get a sugar contact high just watching this movie.
There is so much pastry.
Well, that's the other thing is that there's like a macaron tower in like every third shot in the movie.
It's true.
Also, they must pour a metric fuck ton of champagne over the course of the movie.
That's true, too.
At least every scene has someone having a coupe glass refilled with what is presumably champagne.
I think they put down more macarons and champagne glasses than they do, like, eat them or drink them.
Mm.
There's a lot of, like, dramatic placing down of food and drink.
We talked about this before. That's just actors being smart. You don't want to sit down to a meal scene and then your decision on take one for the master wide shot is like, I'm going to be eating this whole time because then you're just going to spend the next day eating the whole time.
Yep.
And you got to make sure you got to take the bites at the right time. And then you get all scrumbly in your tummy. And that's not fun.
Sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Sounds real bad. Before we get into this wine or this movie.
Right. We got a little business
We got two bits of business.
That's right. So in an ongoing campaign to try and solicit more reviews from our listeners that we know are listening, but we also know are not reviewing the show. And to remind you, reviews help the show find a new audience and maybe in theory raises our profile in the Apple Podcast ecosystem and the other places. I have been doing a carrot and the stick thing. The carrot is if you leave a review and mention your favorite Marvel movie, which Jamie has zero interest in whatsoever, I will make Jamie watch Marvel movies. The stick being, if we do not get any new reviews in a given week to release, I will regale Jamie and therefore the audience with the ongoing saga of renovating my bathroom. And I do have plenty of bathroom updates. However, before we even get into whether or not we have a new review, drum roll, Jamie, last week in our newest review, friend of the show, Rebecca, challenged you to watch 2011's Green Lantern, and I allowed it, though Green Lantern is a DC Comics character. Do tell us your thoughts on Green Lantern.
Well, first of all, I said it on our last episode, and I would like to reiterate what I said.
This is very kind.
And say it out loud.
This is definitely again, going to encourage the audience to leave reviews, but please go ahead.
F*** you, Rebecca.
Right.
Go f*** yourself. I mean, I could have been doing literally anything but watch this movie, and it would have been time better spent.
The best part is that you're mad at Rebecca, and not for me, for coming up with like a mechanism by which I force you to watch movies through no coercive action whatsoever, except saying into a microphone for a few dozen people that you're going to do it. And you have not argued with it at all the entire time.
Yeah, and I'm going to continue that because I like this way better.
Right.
Just getting mad at our listeners.
It's the audience's fault and not my fault.
That's right.
Yeah. So what did you think of Green Lantern?
It's a big steaming pile of nothing. There's like maybe two ideas in the whole thing that I find to be like kernels of something.
I feel like it's fewer than that, but I also haven't seen the movie since it came out 11 years ago.
I began like, okay, so Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
Bad. Not generally in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, now he's just Ryan Reynolds boring because right. he just plays the Deadpool just, right. all the time. But yeah.
But in this movie, he like has no personality. He's clearly just fighting whatever instincts that he actually has
yeah.
to do the thing. And he's a big old steaming pile of nothing.
Yeah.
And you're stuck with him the whole time. And also, the suit looks so laughably bad. Actually, I take that back. It's not laughable because it's not even funny. It's just bad.
It's not just that it's all CGI. It's that it also is bad design choices.
Correct.
I feel like the domino mask, even if it was like a sculpted piece of foam, rubber, latex that they, you know, spirit gum to his face, that design of his mask would still have looked bad.
I agree.
The idea of like the pulsing green veins emanating from his logo and yep. tracing down throughout his body.
Not good.
A poor design choice.
Super bad.
Looks weird.
Weird and bad. But that being said, he gets his powers. He like realizes what's going on. He goes into a trance and recites the Green Lantern oath.
In brightest day and darkest night, no evil shall escape my sight.
Yes.
For those who worship evil's might, beware my power, Green Lantern's light. Yeah, Jamie, I read comic books as a child. Go fuck yourself, okay? I'm sorry.
No, my problem wasn't you reciting it.
NES games. I was reading Green Lantern comic books.
I was just remembering when the oath gets called back mm-hmm. at the end of the movie, how like zero drama comes along with
it. Oh, because he calls it back when the yellow cloud attacks and it's his like moment of doubt. And then he calls it and does a thing.
And it's supposed to be this big triumphant moment. And you're like, oh yeah, this was a throwaway moment 2 hours ago
yeah.
that I had completely forgotten about and has no resonance right now.
Yeah.
None at all.
I mean, that's just the whole movie. There's no resonance whatsoever. It's just a bunch of nothing.
I guess the one kernel. I'll. You're right. There aren't two kernels of something good. There's one.
Yeah.
And the one is the training sequence with Kilowog.
Yeah.
Not that Kilowog looks good or is particularly performed well.
No.
But like Ryan Reynolds getting beaten up, essentially. Like that's fun. That little bit, that like 10 minutes was fun.
Everybody needs a montage. Montages are fun. Training montages. There's a reason that they're in like all sports movies and why they're some of the most fun parts of like superhero origin stories.
Right.
They're fun. Montages, a good time.
There's so much, like they hint at so much. They talk about the vastness of space and how many Green Lanterns there are and how huge their sectors are. And like, how young humans are and why they're not worthy to have the ring or whatever. And there's a lot to explore there. And you could have done it on Oa.
Yeah.
But then you return him to Earth to basically whine about not wanting to take this up.
Well, if everything was in
for a fucking hour.
If everything was on Oa, Jamie, they wouldn't have been able to take as much of advantage of those Louisiana tax breaks. Which is the only reason the movie is set in New Orleans, because of those sweet, sweet Louisiana tax breaks circa like 2010 to 2014 or 15, which is why mysteriously so many like big movies were set in New Orleans in that time period.
Great. Well, if that's the case, then I don't know. Fucking write it better. It was a steaming pile of nothing.
Well, yeah, it has a perfunctory first act and then a second act that feels like it lasts like three seasons of television mm-hmm. in which nothing happens. And he doesn't put the ring on for a while. And I really don't remember the movie very well. And then the third act, and it's like very obligatory. And the cloud monster shows up and he does a couple of green things and he makes a turret that shoots green bullets. And then the movie's over.
And you have Samantha Waller.
Amanda Waller. Yeah.
There are compelling bits about that character. And they even come through a little bit in this movie. But then she's like thrown aside. There's just like Green Lantern is such a cool idea.
Yeah. Well, I said this to you the other day after you had watched it, which is like the easiest Green Lantern story in the world is Training Day in space.
Right.
Like, and they have Sinestro in the movie played by Mark Strong giving really good, like, you know, noble elder veteran cop vibes, but like he's seen too much shit. And then the whole his arc to turning into the bad guy is saved somehow between the end of the movie and his post-credit scene when he's just like yellow and evil, setting up a sequel that no one wanted and never happened.
Thank God.
The only continuation of Green Lantern is that, like, Ryan Reynolds makes a bunch of jokes about him in the Deadpool movies.
Right.
But yeah, like, the easiest thing in the world. Sinestro is Denzel in Training Day. And Hal Jordan, Ryan Reynolds would be Ethan Hawke. And he's, like, learning the ropes. But then by the end of the movie, he realizes that the veteran cop who's training him to be a space green ring cop is actually evil and then has to fight against him. Like, boom.
Right.
Structure. There you go. But instead it's instead not
we got
that.
Nothing. And with vision, like, the visuals are then, like, a thing that you could be creative with and have fun and do cool things.
Yeah.
And then fucking, he makes guns for himself.
Pretty boring.
He does chains.
Very unimaginative movie. Yeah.
Didn't like it.
Very bad.
Not happy that I watched it.
So how do we feel about Thor Ragnarok now?
Same as I did, but yeah. Like, you know, if you give me a choice between the two of them, 1,000 times out of 1,000, I will choose Thor Ragnarok.
Yes, bad movie.
Yeah.
Green Lantern, very bad movie. Well, if you want to hear more conversations like this, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts that allows you to leave reviews. And you can pick your favorite Marvel or Marvel adjacent movie, and I'll make Jamie watch it. but we do have a new review.
We do.
We have a new one. Jamie, why don't you read this review here?
All right. New review from Mary Catherine Vesco. Lovely listener from British Columbia in Canada. She emailed us her review, as we have asked international listeners to do. So her review is podcast about wine and movies.
And it looks like she gave us a 5-star rating.
Definitely 5 stars right here.
Yeah.
As a wine person, I got you, Jamie. Smiley face. During these 500 days of summer, be sure to tune in to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. Jaws is the best. Listen to the unscripted and genuine affectionate banter between two best friends discussing movies they've paired with wine. Get out of the house and walk while you listen, or better yet, road trip and just drive. Best film reference yet was Time to Put Away Childish Things from the OG 1992 Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, props to Scott. The Miyazaki trifecta episode is my new favorite and a must listen. Not familiar with the Marvel Universe, so my request is that you please watch, pair, and review Slashback by Nyla Inuksuk, and that Scott drink Oshti Zarej Krashki Taran from Slovenia. Cheers.
Well, a lovely review. Very kind, very generous, very flattering. Thank you so much, Mary Catherine. I have a few comments. One, I do like how she snuck a couple of movie titles into her thing.
Yep.
500 Days of Summer, very bad movie, but nice that you snuck it in very organically.
Right.
It is currently
summertime.
I agree. Jaws is the best, one of the greats. Jamie didn't really emphasize this too much, but she also said, get out of the house in reference to Jordan Peele's first feature film. And just drive in reference to the Nicholas Winding Refn,
yes.
Ryan Gosling driver who drives badassly, monosyllabically, and wears that super sweet satin jacket with the scorpion on the back of it. And one, I don't remember saying Time to Put Away Childish Things. I guess I said that on an episode at some point.
Yeah. It sounds like a thing that you would say.
Probably. But also, I've never seen the 1992 Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, and I didn't know that that would have been a reference. And had I seen that movie and still said that, that still would not have been a reference to that. Yeah, I've never seen the movie because its legacy, especially like for somebody like me who, despite its creator, it turns out being like a complete fucking monster, I still have a lot of affection for the Buffy the Vampire Slayer TV series.
Right.
The legacy of the movie is that like the script was butchered and the producers and the director like didn't do well by Monsieur Whedon's original screenplay, and that the tone is wrong. And I just, yeah, I've never seen it, but I'm glad I accidentally referenced it. And also I agree that the Miyazaki episode was super rad, and thank you for enjoying it. So Slashback, the movie that Mary Catherine suggested, this movie sounds, by the way, extremely cool. We will have to watch it at some point. It is a 2022 Canadian film. Jamie, did you read anything up on this?
I did not, no.
Here's the synopsis that's on Letterboxd. In a remote Arctic community, a group of Inuit girls fight off an alien invasion, all while trying to make it to the coolest party in town. I've heard a lot of comparisons between this movie and Attack the Block, which is a 2011 sci-fi adventure movie, Jamie, that actually rules and you would like. unlike Green Lantern. but yeah, so this movie premiered at South by Southwest earlier this year. It does have U.S. distribution through RLJE Films and Shudder. So the movie will have some kind of theatrical release before it streams on Shudder later this year. When it becomes available to us, we'll check it out because it sounds dope and we appreciate the recommendation. But in the meantime, Jamie, I guess you dodge a bullet because she didn't have a Marvel movie to make you watch.
Right.
I mean, I could just pick one.
Motherfucker.
That doesn't seem fair. She didn't name one.
I don't think that you should unilaterally.
Yeah, I don't think I get to do that.
No.
All right. All right, Jamie. You've dodged this bullet this time. This time. Only this time. But yeah, lovely review. Very flattering. Lots of jokes. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And listeners out there, you all just follow Mary Catherine's example and do the same, please.
And follow Mary Catherine on Instagram. She's at Sip Right Repeat. I have to say, on the wine side here, I thought that I knew a handful of things about Slovenian wine. And then this series of proper nouns was presented in front of me, and I was completely confounded, have no idea which is the producer, which is the region, which is the grape. It turns out Tiran is the style of wine. Krashki is the region, as in from Krash, and Oshti Zharej is the producer. This is not available in the United States. I'm looking into finding another producer of Krashki Tiran for us to sample. I know that it is a red wine, emblematic of Western Eurocentric views in wine. Really, the only Slovenian wine that I'm familiar with is from Western Slovenia in the Gorska Brda area. This is from the far eastern side of the country. So I'm going to have to learn me a few more things about Slovenian wine, it turns out. And I'm excited to taste this wine.
I might be excited to taste it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I know nothing. I don't even know what grapes go into it. Like, finding information on this style of wine in this region is difficult in the English language.
Mm. Which you also struggle with, the English language.
Printed, written down. I get it. I can't read, you fucking motherfucker.
I guess we should talk about the food.
Yeah, we had dinner the other night.
We did. I
got
went,
Scott out to a restaurant.
I went to, don't patronize me. Don't fucking patronize me, all right? You son of a bitch.
But we had a good time.
It was delicious.
And we were outside.
All of the food was very good.
The service was very good.
The service was very good. The drone that hovered over the...
was not great.
That was kind of annoying and creepy.
So the restaurant is, as we said, Irwin's upstairs. It's in the Bach building. It's at about 8th and Mifflin Street. So what was your favorite dish of the meal, Scott?
Ooh, Tani and I were talking about this. We always do this after we leave a restaurant, is we rank the dishes.
Yeah.
And she and I were both really keen on the chicken.
The chicken was fucking
The chicken dope. Was outstanding. The chicken was great. I wasn't as hot on the fish as you were, in part because I had to watch you fucking pry the eyes out of the fish with a knife and then pop them in. It was a full fish.
You eat the eyeball.
Disagree. One, I don't order a whole fish. Two, gross. No, the chicken was outstanding. What was the one with the rabbit, with the braised rabbit?
Fazzoletti.
The fazzoletti with the rabbit is probably my favorite dish.
I think that's mine too. Yeah.
And then the chicken.
The eggplant caponata was stunningly delicious.
The caponata was really good. The fucking fennel salad was outstanding.
I agree with
Super
that.
Super fresh. I love the fennel salad.
Lots of acid in that one.
Gnocchi too. The gnocchi that you paired the wine to. The gnocchi was outstanding.
Yeah, I agree. I think the gnocchi might have been the outstanding dish had the fazzoletti not been there. The texture on the eggplant against the texture on the pasta itself,
yeah.
I think is a really beautiful contrast. Mm-hmm. And like that little bit of burn from the chilies. It's just like one of those homey, warm kind of dishes.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty great. Also the tiramisu. The tiramisu was super dope. It was like cakier than I'm used to in tiramisu, and yeah. I appreciated that. I liked that it was a little more, because sometimes tiramisu can just feel like nothing. It can just be like light and fluffy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this had some contrasting texture that I really enjoyed.
That was really good. The cherries with the like sage whipped cream.
The cherries were really good.
Long story short, everything
was good.
Was outstanding.
Everything was good. Even half the company or two thirds of the company was great.
You're a jerk.
I enjoyed
Your wife's company?
My wife, I enjoyed. Your friend Genevieve enjoyed her company as well. You were fine. The three of us basically just made fun of you the entire night. So I guess that was fun. And you know what? You were a trooper about it. I actually realized it in the on the car on the way home that we did just make fun of you the entire time we were there. And that you were a good boy about it, as you always or usually are.
I mean, all press is good press, Scott. I like attention.
You really liked it when Genevieve and I both suggested that maybe someone else try to read the menu for you.
You fucking people. My best friend and my partner teaming up on me. Not okay.
Mm. But yeah, mega, mega nummy. I really enjoyed it. Shout out to the chef and to the service and to your friend, the bartender. What was his name?
Michael. Yeah. So Michael Lancaster is an ex-employee, but before that he was a friend, remains a friend. Michael is, I've been yelling about it for a couple of years. I finally get a Michael Lancaster beverage program. He has studiously stayed away from being the wine buyer, whatever, at restaurants that he's worked at. And I've been yelling at him for it for a long time. And I'm happy that he is now taking over the full beverage program at Irwin's. And I'm excited to see what he does with it. The cocktails that he dropped off, I thought were spectacular.
Melon cucumber punch. Yep. That was really nummy.
That was real good.
I have to say, I wasn't super crazy about the rosé, but I don't blame him because you picked that. So that's your responsibility.
Thank you, buddy.
The rosé was fine.
The rosé was delicious.
It was fine.
Shut your mouth.
Was definitely better than the gross Amaro that was brought over complimentarily, and I'm very grateful for that, but I do not care for Amaro.
Scotty just don't like Amaro.
I just don't like things that taste like that.
It's good. It tastes good.
Sure.
So, Michael Lancaster is the bar manager, and then Michael Ferrari is the chef. He's been in Philly for a long time, and I'm really happy to see the whole team succeeding at Irwin's.
Yeah, I had a ball. I highly recommend people go there. And if you get there early, like I did, because I thought I was going to have to spend a fucking year and a half of my life finding South Philly parking, as I usually do in the evening times. And then miraculously, a spot opened up right on Mifflin.
Yep.
Which has never happened to me before whenever I've tried to go to Bach. So we had an hour to kill and we went to Bach Bar right across the hall. And that was also a delightful time.
The nice thing about Bach Bar is that it has that northerly view of the city.
The view is much better. Because Irwin has a view of the stadium, which, you know, when it was lit up, the glow of the lights and everything was very handsome. But yeah, Bach Bar has that, view of that Philly skyline view. Quite handsome.
It's real good.
Yeah.
So gnocchi and everything else at Irwin's, go get it.
Yeah, I'm trying to conjure some sense memories of the food that we ate and to think if I think this wine would have paired with any of them. And I don't know, because I'm not good at that.
I think that this wine would have paired well with both of the pastas. Obviously, I think that about the gnocchi, because I made this call.
Yeah.
But the rabbit, too. This, I think, goes really well with tomato in general.
Because the acidity in the tomato and...
And the soft plushness of this wine.
I wouldn't say this is soft and plush.
I
find the tannin contradictory with soft plushness.
But it's got these really silky... really well-resolved tannins. They're not like angular and abrasive. They're just...
I mean, until I swallow, and then it's very tannic.
The finish, yeah, they get there a little bit, but like especially with a braised dish like the rabbit, the tannins would be calmed down quite a bit.
You know what? I think this would have been nice with the chicken too.
Also, yes.
Because that really dark sauce that was
that agro dulce.
Is that what that was?
Yeah.
It was like a balsamic and chicken fat and it was... dark and a little burnt, and I feel like that would have tasted even better contrasting with the tannins and the fruit in this.
Yep.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
That was a fucking outstanding dish. It looked so good. It just looked great. Like everything looked great coming out.
Right.
But then that chicken in particular, the color. Ooh.
A chicken dish is such a good barometer for a great restaurant.
Yeah.
Like if they have chicken on the menu and you suspect that there might be a great chef in the kitchen, order the chicken. If it is superlative, or rather, if the chef is really great, it will probably be the best dish on the menu.
Why is that? Well, what about chicken? Is it because chicken is so versatile and you can do lots of stuff with it?
It's very easy to make chicken okay, which is why it's so ubiquitous in our everyday life.
Yeah.
But it's really difficult to make it what we had the other night.
Mm.
It takes a lot of preparation and skill and know-how, and then the execution is where things can fall completely apart, and they put out a consistently juicy, perfectly cooked bird every single time.
Yeah. I feel like there's one dish we forgot to mention.
The crudo.
The crudo is really good, too. What was in that crudo?
I don't remember what fish the crudo was.
Yeah.
Because it's not on the menu, and I think it rotates. But the crudo had, like, a chili oil and, I think, melon and celery. I may be wrong about that. I just remember it being really bright and fresh, mm-hmm. having, like, a little sting of spice.
Yeah. The crudo was delicious, too. Yeah. Good meal. We'll go back.
And the olives. Don't forget the olives.
I did forget the olives because I didn't eat them because I don't like olives, Jamie.
Did you try the caperberries?
No, because they looked exactly like the olives and I wasn't running any risks. Also, I don't really like capers.
Man, more Scotty bad takes. I don't like olives and I don't like capers.
Oh, I'm Jamie. Oh, I didn't like Green Lantern.
I really did.
I'm not saying that to disagree with you or say that that's a bad take. I'm just saying that that's what you sound like. I'm Jamie. I didn't like Green Lantern. Congratulations, Jamie. Nobody liked Green Lantern.
I really did like the part in the evening where your wife condescendingly explained to you what the difference between capers and caperberries was. I enjoyed that.
I thought she did that very poorly as well. I still don't understand.
I thought it was a perfect explanation.
She could have just said that the caper is the small green thing and the caperberry is the larger green thing.
Right, but that's less accurate than what she said.
But what she said confused me more.
Well, that's because you're not very smart.
But she said that the caper is the flower.
Uh-huh, and the caperberry is the berry.
But they're both small green round things. She could have just said one is a small green round thing and one is a slightly larger small green round thing.
She was trying to give you more information to illuminate the difference between the
two. But I wasn't going to eat it no matter what.
These
capers.
What do you think about this wine, Scott?
It smells good.
Yep. Does it have regular old wine smell?
It's a little fruitier than regular old wine smell.
I think so,
too. Than the child's signature regular old wine smell. I haven't really been describing the look as much, but this is purple, right?
Yeah.
This is a purple.
Purple out to a salmon rim, perhaps?
I disagree with salmon, but okay. Purple, and somewhere between medium and deep. It could be a little darker. It's a little. It's not fully opaque. It's just very darkly translucent.
Yeah.
A lot of fruit.
Lots of fruit.
It smells like it should be sweet. It smells like it.
But it isn't.
But it isn't sweet.
Not sweet.
It's not sweet. But it smells like it. There's like blueberries and a little bit of like a fresh cranberry smell.
Fresh cranberry big time.
Maybe like kind of like a cinnamon or like a hint of a nutmeg thing on the nose.
Look at you picking up oak.
Oh, is that's oak?
Those are oak indicators. Yeah. And this wine has oak.
I didn't pick that
up.
But
you picked up the indicators correctly. Well done. A round of applause, everyone.
And then on mouth taster.
On mouth.
There's some spice on the back end.
The next exam I take.
On mouth?
I'm going to. Every one of the six wines. And on mouth?
Mouth confirms nose.
On the schnuffer?
Hey, man, I'm a trendsetter, okay? I make words happen. Oh, my God, I miss my Ritalin so much. This is a real problem. A little bit of a spice, a little bit of a burn on the back end, especially around the swallow.
On the swallow.
The tannins are... Maybe it's just been a while since I've had like a tannic red wine, but the tannins are leaving my mouth dry in a way that I'm not enjoying. I'm enjoying everything up until the tannins and the mild, fine grit sandpaper. This is like a, I forget which, if the higher number means a finer grit.
Higher number is finer grit. Yeah.
What the fuck do you know about sandpaper, Jamie?
I know that.
All right, so then we're talking like a 150. We're talking like a drywall sandpaper, essentially. Okay.
Noted.
Or even like a sanding sponge, like a drywall sanding sponge. Oh wow! All right, so this glass has had much more time in the decanter than the previous. Borderline sweet notes of sweet things suddenly available or apparent. Is there like a plum thing? There's some kind of a stewed thing. Stewed stone fruit or like a stewed red fruit. There's something in there. Not almost actually
like a fruit pie almost.
Yeah. Cherries, stewed cherries, maybe somewhat adjacent to the baked cherries that we had for dessert at Irwin's upstairs. That's it. That's all I got.
You haven't answered. Do you like it or not?
Oh yeah, it's good. It's very good. I don't spoilers for next week's episode, which we're recording in a few hours. I don't like it as much as the
Nebbiolo from
Nebbiolo that I paired an upcoming title to.
Right.
But yeah, very, very nummy, very tasty. I feel like it probably would go better with food.
I think it's pretty good on its own. Personally, I'm not offended by these tannins at all.
I'm not offended, but they are a bit of a detractor.
I'm surprised because the Poderi Cola has higher tannin than this wine does.
But it has more things that I like too.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah. I like the body of that more because that one is a pretty high body.
It's
full body.
I would put them kind of around the same.
No, that one is a fuller body.
Has higher alcohol.
That would explain how drunk I got last night then off a very hearty glass.
Mm. It's a good wine. It's a really good wine. I fucking love this stuff.
It's really good. It tastes very good.
Yeah.
I just like the next one more.
Right.
And I'm not enjoying these tannins right now. But otherwise, I quite like this wine. What are the other notes? What are the things that I'm not getting that you're getting?
I mean, you hit on a lot of them. I think that there's a big cranberry thing here. I think there's less of a darker fruit note than you do. But, you know, taste being subjective. This is almost like a cranberry raspberry juice cocktail from Ocean Spray kind of situation.
You really do like the Ocean Spray note.
It's a touchstone from my childhood.
But is that a Jamie thing or is that like a wine people thing? Do other people talk about Ocean Spray?
They do. I probably talk about it more. I use it as a touchstone when I'm tasting blind for both this grape and the grape that we're tasting next, actually.
Nebbiolo.
Yeah, for Pinot Noir and Nebbiolo, I get some variation on cranberry, be it like cranberry sauce or fresh cranberries or cranberry juice cocktail or like bitter cranberry juice. That's sort of where I live when I'm thinking about Pinot Noir and Nebbiolo.
That is the thing that's making me think of sweetness. Is it's not just that it's cranberry. It's like canned cranberry sauce. That is the cranberry note that I'm getting. That like perfect, cheap, low rent Thanksgiving side that no one should turn their nose up at.
It's delicious.
Because I like making, you know, a regular actual cranberry sauce with just some cranberries and some water and a fuck lot of sugar and you boil it for a while. That's great.
Yep. But so is just a can slid out onto a plate.
The can gets the job done.
It does.
Nothing fancy about it.
It does something totally different.
Yeah. It's gelatinous. It's product and less food.
Right.
And I like it.
And it goes with turkey.
Yeah, this is really good.
Yeah.
I think this is
more red fruited. I really like, you know, I think that there's significant oak presence to this wine, that like nutmeg cinnamon thing that you were picking up. I think there's also some vanilla bean here. And I think it's really well integrated. It doesn't stick out. It's not this like obnoxious oak bomb. It's kind of right where it should be.
And that's the oak is the vanilla and the baking spices.
Correct. Yes.
Is oak.
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to try to remember that for next time.
There's also a little bit of a like a star anise thing going on here that I find very pleasant. And while I wrote down floral roses, I think that this vintage is less roses and more violets. But that's, you know, that happens based on the year.
Well, I don't need a lot of flowers, so I can neither confirm nor deny.
Do you smell them? I mean, like in life, do you stop and smell the roses?
Not really.
I know.
And we have a rose bush right out there. I don't ever go out and smell the roses.
You should stop and smell the roses sometime.
All right. I'm going to stop this recording. Jamie, you should leave. I'm going to go smell some roses. Tell me about the story of this wine that I don't care about.
Yeah.
I like this wine and I've enjoyed discussing the flavors. Now tell me about the narrative of the wine.
Well, so once again, I'm going to invoke Burgundy.
I'm sorry, what?
Burgundy.
Did you just say Burgundy?
I said Burgundy.
I think the first time you said Burgundy.
I said Burgundy.
Guys, the tannins have ruined Jamie's tongue's ability to move. It's too tannic. That's why you said Burgundy.
It's not very tannic.
Your tongue is fat and numb in your mouth and rolling about like a drunk person.
This wine for me tastes a lot like Burgundy.
Burgundy.
For sure, like warm area, warm vintage Burgundy. but it has those hallmarkers. It has the acidity. It has the tannins. It's structured like a Burgundy. It has that like silkiness, but it does have a lot more fruit to it, which points us to a warmer climate somewhere in not Europe. So this is in the Rio Negro area of Patagonia. We're at the like extreme south end of South America here. It's all sandy and silty loam soils. And the owner of this estate was drawn here by the old vine Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir. That was...
You don't do it as well as I do.
I know. Do it again.
Pinot Noir.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, yeah, that was a line reading. Now you try.
Pinot Noir.
That was better. One more time, Jamie. Try it again.
Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir. All right. Please continue.
The estate was actually, though, founded by an Italian man who is the son of the guy who created Sassicaia in Bulgari. Sassicaia, for those of you who know anything about wine, is the first Super Tuscan.
Super Tuscans. I've been waiting for Super Tuscans ever to come back up on this show because I was so delighted the first time you said Super Tuscans. Hang on.
It's a good name for a category of wine.
It's a good name for literally anything. If there was a make of Italian car that was called Super Tuscan,
yeah,
I would want to buy one of those. If there was a comic book character called Super Tuscan or a team of Italian superheroes called the Super Tuscans, would buy it. Honestly, it would even be a great name for like a group of Italian fascists. The Super Tuscans. I'm not saying I would support their like politics, but I would appreciate the branding. Now, for our semi-regularly scheduled segment on the show, In Memoriam, Dear Friend Johnny Words, in which we honor his memory.
Rest in peace.
By doing his favorite thing that I used to do on the show, which was ask Jamie to explain something he has explained on microphone before.
Yes.
Can you please, to honor dear sweet Johnny Words, explain what a Super Tuscan is?
Okay, well, in honor of dearly departed J Words.
Rest in peace, J Words. Dan Jaworski.
A Super Tuscan is a wine from Tuscany that does not fall within the established appellations of the region. So it started with people wanting to plant international varieties, i.e. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot. And when I say international, mostly it means French, because reasons. And they wanted to make these wines, and the authorities that be didn't want them made, so they just labeled them table wine, vino da tavola.
So the Super Tuscans are like rebels.
Correct.
Wow. And it's not that they're like mega Tuscans. It's that super like above and beyond, super outside of Tuscany, essentially.
Yep.
But geographically within Tuscany.
Yep.
But from grapes that are not legally allowed because of the stupid European appellation laws.
Correct.
And that shit's so dumb. But it at least did give us Super Tuscans.
You know what's funny, though? In Sassicaia's case, they now have their own appellation, which is called Bulgari Sassicaia DOC.
So they're no longer a Super Tuscan?
I mean, they are because they were, you know, the first in 1961 or whatever. But yeah, now they have an appellation.
And that's Sassicaia?
Sassicaia.
Wow. Not at all how I would have thought that was spelled. Well, I hope that they are happy with themselves because they used to be called Super Tuscans, a rad name, and now they're called what?
Bulgari Sassicaia. I mean, Super Tuscan was never on the label. That was just a thing that colloquially...
Missed opportunity.
I agree.
Super Tuscan.
And it's kind of insane that it's been going on for more than half a century and no one has put Super Tuscan on a label.
It's a huge missed opportunity.
It really is.
Red and yellow Pentagon shield with the S, Super Tuscan, try to avoid getting sued by the Time Warner Discovery media conglomerate.
So anyway, the son of the guy who created Sassicaia purchased an estate in Patagonia, and that's Bodega Chakra. He then hired a very high-powered consultant, Jean-Marc Rouleau, to help him make wine. Jean-Marc Rouleau of Domaine Rouleau in Burgundy. So they're making Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in Patagonia, which are the same grapes that they make in Burgundy. Rouleau is a spectacularly talented winemaker. His wines are some of the most profound expressions of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay that I've ever tasted. They are also, at this point, incredibly, massively, unreasonably overpriced because of all of the hype and the low supply of them. So it's kind of nice to be able to taste his handiwork at, what was this, $20, $23, $24.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. I was looking to see if anyone made a Super Tuscan t-shirt with the Superman logo on it. And there is a Super Tuscan t-shirt that my quick Googling found, but it's got a picture of like a Basset hound, like an anthropomorphic Basset hound in like 15th century. It looks like your typical picture of like a Shakespearean actor with like the pantaloons and the tunic and a cape. And he's wearing boots, and it's got like, what is that called? The Italian wine thing that like normally you see Chianti in, the Italian
wine. Fiasco bottle.
Where it's got like the wicker thing around the base, and that's his shadow. I'm not really on board with this t-shirt. I feel like it should just have the Superman shield, and it says Superman shield, Uber Tuscan. Truth, justice, and the Italian Francified way.
There is a t-shirt that I'm seeing that has Sasakaya, but in the Slayer font.
I mean, that's cool.
Pretty good.
That's not bad.
But that's about it. So yeah, that's Bodega Chakra. This is their Barda bottling, which is a blend of, you know, some of their vineyards that all lie on this, what they call Barda soil, which is sandy, silty loam. They do a lot of higher end single vineyard bottlings that are also spectacular, but for this price, I can't get away from how delicious this wine is. And I'm really happy that you also like it.
And this is in the $20, $22, $23 range.
Yes, correct.
That was very confusing the way that you said that.
$26 from Crush.
Jesus, Jamie.
I know.
$26. It's nummy. I feel like it would go better with food than with conversation, but it's very nummy. I enjoy it. Audience, who cares? I endorse this wine selection. Everyone should drink it and enjoy. That said, spoilers for, 45 minutes from now, I do not think it pairs with this movie at all.
I fully disagree with that.
Wow, you're stupid.
No, you are. If you're pairing it to the pastries in this movie, for sure, it doesn't work with the pastry.
No, not to the pastries, but to, I guess like as a contrapuntal thing, but it feels fundamentally the opposite of this movie. This movie needs champagne, because this movie is all about bubbles and fizz and airiness and brightness, and this is not that.
I think that this has a lot of brightness, and this matches the color palette.
This does not match the color palette. The color palette of the movie is light, low contrast, and pastels. And this is not any of those things.
Scott's way too literal, everybody.
No, this is the problem. You said it matches the color palette. I just described for you the color
feeling,
palette.
The feeling of the wine matches the color palette of the movie.
That is a stupid thing to say and doesn't make any sense.
This is what we're doing on this podcast, Scott.
Right, but I'm doing it right and you're doing it badly. The feeling of this wine does not match the color palette of the movie.
Let's talk about the damn movie before we argue about the fucking pairing.
That rosé that you picked to go with our dinner at Irwin's the other night, that matches the color palette. The color of that and the feeling of that wine matches the color palette of this movie.
I'm done arguing with you. You're wrong, but I'm done.
Well, that's the end of the show, everybody. my long con after 52 episodes has finally come to a conclusion. You all heard it. I've got a verbal commitment from Jamie, which we all know means a lot because he committed to watch fucking Marvel movies with no gun to his head whatsoever. Jamie has now conceded that he'll never argue with me ever again. This show's purpose has been concluded. Well, let's just talk about it.
Yeah.
Marie Antoinette, 2006's Marie Antoinette. This is the third feature film from Sofia Coppola, yes, of that particular Coppola clan.
And I didn't choose her wine.
Does she have her own bottling from Papa Coppola's, from Frank's vintage?
From her own.
Does she really? Yeah. Well, she's following Dad's example.
Pretty delicious canned sparkling wine that was way ahead of the curve as far as putting good wine into a can.
I want that now. That sounds great. And I think she has impeccable taste. So I bet the wine is probably good.
It's good.
Although I've never really liked any of the Francis wines that I've had, but I've always had the lower end bottlings. I've heard that
his
top shelf ones are better.
Yeah, he owned Inglenook, which is one of the magisterial Napa estates.
Yeah.
The ones under the Coppola label, Plonk. No good.
Those were Plonk?
I think so.
Frank, no. Well, whatever. I'm glad he sold the vineyard for $100 million.
Right. fucking whatever. But he also like oversaw Inglenook, which is one of the more important historic estates of Napa and has historically made spectacular wine and continued to under his leadership.
Hmm. I didn't realize he owned multiple vineyards.
The Coppola wines were made out of the Inglenook estate, but the labels were different and the fruit sourcing was different.
Interesting. Well, anyway, I didn't realize that Sophia had her own brand. It comes in cans. Mm-hmm. That is a very, that feels very much like Sophia Coppola, where it's like the mixture of like high and low art, you know?
And they're like the elegant kind of like skinny cans. And it just says Sophia on the label.
Word. Sounds great. But yeah, this is her third feature film after her debut, The Virgin Suicides, her second feature, Lost in Translation, and now this is her third. This is, if we were to borrow from the parlance of my favorite movie podcast, Blank Check, this is the Blank Check. Lost in Translation is like the indie movie that didn't cost very much and made a ton of money and got a bunch of Oscar nominations, and then, you know, her follow-up movie is like, yeah, I'm going to do Marie Antoinette and I'm going to do it sort of anachronistically and we're going to film some of it actually at Versailles. But so the movie begins with the young Austrian Archduchess, Marie Antoinette, played, I think, magnificently by Kirsten Dunst, on her way to France to marry the young man-child, failed son, Dauphin Louis the 16th, played resplendently by by Jason Schwartzman, a truly fearless Jason Schwartzman performance, never afraid to look foolish, stupid, and impotent throughout the movie. And like what follows is less of a plotty tale of palace intrigue and political loyalties, and it's more just about vibes. Like it's a Sofia Coppola movie. It's about vibes and atmosphere and place and texture and the emotional experience of being the person going through all of it. As we watch Marie learning the ways of Versailles, struggling with the expectations foisted upon her both by her new French royal family that she's married into and the political necessities of the Austrian royal family that married her off to, you know, bridge the gap and ease the peace with the son that she is unable to produce for quite a while. In fact, ever.
She produces a son.
Shut up.
Don't
okay,
you?
Okay, fine.
When they're all like screaming, "And Dauphin, and Dauphin."
Oh, that's right. And Dauphin. She did. Yeah, she did produce her son.
The second child was a boy.
Right, and then the third child was a stillborn. Was it a portrait montage that broke my heart?
That was really. I had to rewind.
It's
that
so beautiful
to just like. I was like, did that just happen?
It's so elegantly depicted.
Yes, it is.
It's part of the elasticity of time in the movie that I love so much that we just skip over that entirely. And it just happens in two successive shots of portraits being hung. But yeah, the movie, you know, it's great. And the cast is completely outstanding. Aside from Kirsten Dunst and Jason Schwartzman, it also stars Judy Davis, Steve Coogan, Rip Torn as Louis the 15th. Who is spectacular in his complete rip-tornness. Rose Byrne, Asia Argento, Molly Shannon, Shirley Henderson, Danny Houston, Jamie Dornan, and in a very small role, a young Tom Hardy. And as mentioned, as of this episode's recording and hopefully release, it will remain on The Who of Lou. It's also available for your rental wherever you get your VODs, and everybody should watch it because the movie is so charming. And so delightful and so impeccably crafted. It was nominated for and won the Academy Award for Best Costume Design, which of course it did because this is the movie that the Oscars give the Costume Design Award for. Yep. If you made a 19th century French period piece, like you just get the Costume Design Award unless you totally fucked it up and sat on your balls. Shut up. It was the 18th century, Jamie.
18th century, Scotty. It was the end of the 18th century.
The very end. It might as well have been the early 19th century, Jamie.
I mean, they talk about the American Revolution.
Right.
Which happened in the 18th century. Also, Louis the 16th did not survive into the 19th century.
All right. Well, Jamie clearly
because the French Revolution
had someone
happened.
Read him the Wikipedia about all of this
Mother
after he watched the movie. Anyway, the movie is lovely. What did you think of it there, Jim Jam?
This is very much a type of movie that I love to watch. It is, as you say, about vibe, but it's also about the people and less about the things that happen.
plot is almost always secondary in Sofia Coppola movies.
Right.
And it's about the emotional journey more than anything.
I feel like plot takes a stronger role here than maybe it did in some of her, like Lost in Translation. And part of that is, this is history, right? We know what happens. So you have to sort of doff your cap at like the American Revolution and then the French Revolution. They more than doff the cap to the French Revolution. Anyway, yeah, the characters and the vibes and there is artistic license taken with all of the design. And I thought particularly the design on the hair and the wigs being a little bit there. It's like a little bit late 90s, early aughts with the like hairspray mousse kind of situation. It's a little bit more angular than perhaps your more like, quote unquote, historically accurate depictions might be.
Do you know enough about that to know that it's that's
true? I know that it's different from other depictions that I've seen. And I know that the look of it looks like it looks both like what I've seen and like late 90s, early aughts style.
Interesting. I was alive and paying attention in the late 90s and early aughts, and I never saw anyone with their hair piled 4 feet above their head Queen Marge Simpson.
That's the part that's like depictions I've seen before, but the angular nature of it and the look of the like sharp hairspray and mousse to it.
Okay. I feel like the hair design is probably not the area that either of us can presume to have any expertise over.
Can you agree with me that it looks different from other depictions that you've seen?
It looks a little more lived in.
It has attitude.
And I don't know. For me, the rep on this movie that I recall from when it first came out, the reviews were not uniformly kind. And I remember a lot of people complaining about the anachronism of the soundtrack in particular.
Which I love, by the way.
It's just great. But like other than the soundtrack, which is all like post new wave and like, you know, punk pop movie or songs from like the late 70s and the 80s and the 90s. There's like New Order and some The Cure and The Strokes and other bands that I haven't heard of before because I don't know anything about music. But like other than the soundtrack and just the general performance from some of the cast, like Rip Torn is not trying to play period accurate French King, neither is Jason Schwartzman. Like they're cast for the emotional truth that they bring to it.
Yeah.
But like other than those two things, I didn't really find it to be terribly anachronistic. Like
I'm not saying that it's terribly anachronistic. I'm saying that there is attitude there, that there is something about the design that they are very clearly not going for historical accuracy. They're going for a vibe.
But I'm saying, and I'm just assuming here, that you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Which is rude.
And
you don't have any specific leg to stand on other than Jamie doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
It looks like every painterly depiction that I have seen that time, plus a lived-in quality. It has what you're describing as attitude doesn't feel period inaccurate to me. It just feels like it's Marie Antoinette, but we see her dancing and sweating and the hair isn't always perfect. It's like the moments after the portrait is painted. It feels like what was always described about that character.
There are elements of the late 90s and the early aughts style to this movie, both in the hair and also in her makeup, especially in that little like the insert shot of her saying, "Let them eat cake." Like that is like the full on eyeshadow situation of that era.
Well, which is itself a moment of fantasy.
Yes, it is.
That the movie dismisses essentially. But I'm saying
it has these elements to it. And I find that interesting and exciting.
Well, I think you're talking out your ass, but I'm also talking out my ass. And so we should move on from discussing the costume and the hair. How about that? Because neither one of us knows what the fuck we're talking about.
Listen, I'm saying that I'm more observant than you are. And I maybe just had an idea of what was going on around me at that time better than you did.
Okay, Jamie, we watched After Yang for last week's episode, and you didn't notice that the fucking dimensions of the image changed repeatedly throughout the movie. So please tell me how observant you are. You can't tell the difference between a square and a rectangle when it changes in front of your face.
We'll leave it to the listeners to decide.
Okay. I'm sure they're educated about the hair makeup stylings of the late 18th century.
In our movie chat, Johnny Words may he rest in peace,
right,
will insert in line whenever this is released,
right,
an argument about the hair and the makeup.
He'll text us, "Hey guys, I'm listening to your new episode. You really need to stop talking about the hair and makeup. Like, please read this to the audience," because he thinks that we record and broadcast the show live whenever it is that he decides to listen to a new episode on demand. All right. I'm going to check with Pri on this one. Pri will have something to say that feels knowledgeable and educated.
That is true.
Do you have anything else to say about the movie except for things that you don't know about?
I had a lot. I just had a really good time watching it. The vibe is fun. I love her emotional journey. It starts so uncomfortable. The bit where she's like crossing the border from Austria.
And they take her little dog away.
They take her dog. They take her clothes.
Yeah.
They redress her. Like the whole thing. And then like, then she gets married and she's feeling maybe a little bit comfortable right up until the point where there is a cardinal basically putting them to bed.
Mm-hmm. And everyone's standing there. And that scene is terrifying because it's like, are they all going to stand there and watch while the two of them consummate the marriage?
Yep.
And like, blessedly, they all didn't.
Up until her sort of feeling her oats and that moment where like, finally, in the morning, the curtains to her bed fling open and she's just like waiting in repose for them as opposed to like sort of waking up terrified by them. And then eventually, finally, like becoming the queen, having a child. It's this view on this woman who was taken out of her element and then she makes her own element. And I really, really enjoyed it.
Something I really like about it is the elastic nature of time in the movie, that like her first day in France is the first 20 minutes. And then her first few, like, time is a little loosey goosey, but it's like maybe her first few years when she's the Dauphine comprises much of the next hour.
Yeah.
And then she becomes the queen and then time just races by and suddenly there's a kid, and then there's another kid.
And then the kid is a toddler, and then the kid is like,
yeah.
Yeah.
It moves along very quickly, and I think it's really important that we spend so much time on the first day to like really show the fish out of water element for her and to show just how alienating and bizarre all of the absurd rituals of Versailles are. Yeah, I really like that elasticity of it and how it just it is racing towards the inevitable. Like anybody watching the Marie Antoinette movie knows where this thing is heading,
right.
And we just like, the closer we get to it, the faster and faster the movie picks up the pace and gets there. But yeah, it's just like, it's another Sofia Coppola thing, is how sensual it is, how much the movie creates the illusion of the other senses.
Yeah.
Like you can feel the texture of the fabrics and the dresses and the sheets, and you can almost imagine the taste of all of the food, how beautifully it's all presented to us.
And even before that, her discomfort just being in Versailles, her feeling like when she's standing there naked in front of everyone and they're like passing her dressing gown along to the highest ranking princess in the room or whatever, that feels tactile. Like she's standing there just waiting and you're like, no, another person just fucking walked in.
Yeah. And then she finally, it's amazing. Like there isn't a lot of dialogue from her, especially in the first half of the movie, because she's a little bit passive along her journey.
Yeah.
But then in that scene where Judy Davis is explaining like, yes, whoever the highest ranking lady in the bedchambers is every single morning, like the highest ranking one is the one who will dress you and bring you your tea and whatever. And then finally they put the dressing gown on her and Kirsten Dunst is like, this is
ridiculous.
She's so good. It is a marvelous performance. And she's so humanizing.
Mm-hmm. And she's able to take you from that fish out of water, that person who doesn't feel at home, who doesn't know what the hell is going on, to the point where Versailles is surrounded and my place is with the king in the palace.
So I kind of agree, but to focus on Kirsten for a second before I get to really my only grievance with the movie. The entire emotional journey is on her back, and it is such a, like, it's one of the magic things that actors can do, where like they can be so transparent in the emotional journey that they're going on, and you just look at her face and you know exactly what she's experiencing without her needing to rely on dialogue.
Right.
We understand her discomfort. We understand her disappointment and rejection and a little bit relief when the Dauphin, when Jason Schwartzman, like, isn't actually, like, trying to go for it and, you know, consummate the damn thing ever. God,
Schwartzman. Her relief and then her anxiety about it.
Right, because everybody's like, yo, when are you going to crank out that baby? And for anybody in the damn building, all you have to do is look at the two of them and be like, he's obviously the reason that she's not pregnant.
Right.
Like, he is the problem. He's obsessed with locks and keys, and he looks like a little boy. Something I love so much about, and it's not just Schwartzman, but like the costuming and everything about the look of that character just makes him look like a boy.
Yeah,
it makes him like the bit where he's about to go off on a fox hunt, and the two of them are like having a moment, and they've warmed up to each other, and they're kind of sweet on each other, and he gives her a kiss, and then. And then, you know, one of his, like, his Batman or whatever, like, has to help him get up on the horse. But his tunic and all of his regalia is so poorly tailored just to make him look small.
Yep.
And to make him look paunchy. And it's just such a ridiculous persona. But yeah, you can just feel her whole emotional journey. And it all happens on Kirsten's face. And then that transition once she's the queen is just so wonderful and so humanizing, right? That, like, you have the let them eat cake moment later on after she and the king, but especially her, have really indulged in the partying and the extravagance and, you know, the fucking and the drinking constantly and all the money that they're spending. What I love, the movie goes to great lengths to, like, humanize the legacy of Marie Antoinette, that, like, no, she wasn't the, like, spoiled rich brat who plundered the coffers of the French, and that the peasants rightly revolted up against her because she was spending away all their money. Like, no, it was her dumbass husband who was throwing money away because his political advisors were telling him what to do. And right. Meanwhile, she is living the lifestyle that is expected of her. Her whole life was about, like, you are young royalty in Austria, and we will marry you off to another power to cement some kind of alliance, and you will have to make a child. And then she gets to Versailles, and it's still that pressure. Plus, you are expected to indulge in the extravagance, and here's the decadence, and here's how we do it. And we have all the servants, and there's all the parties. And then the two of them, he has his coronation, and it's a wonderful moment where he prays to God. He takes a knee, and he's like, God, we pray to you for your support because we are too fucking young to reign. This is not our moment.
Yep.
But, like, well, what are they going to do? Like, rip torn drinks and parties and whores his way across all of France throughout his time.
He bought his concubine a title.
Right. And so it's the next generation. Like, they're going to do the exact same thing, but they're going to party harder and enjoy it and be able to, like, stay up late and be indulgent. But instead, everybody fucking blames her for it. And I just love how the movie goes out of its way to humanize that and be like, no, this is the expectation of a young woman in this position. And now she's damned for doing what everyone, her family, his family, the country, the royals, all of the people of the court and all the intrigue. Everyone wants her to live like this. But now she's going to get blamed for it when, you know, politically and financially, things are not going well in the country. I have a take.
Yes, go ahead. What's your take?
The movie is about Britney Spears.
Huh.
Or not, like, specifically Britney Spears, but, like, it's about a young woman in the 21st century in the spotlight. It is about a young pop star, which is why I think, like, the pop music, not that it's pop music by genre, but, like, the contemporary, you know, pop music soundtrack is so important. It's to, like, key us into the fact that, like, we should look at this with a modern lens. It's about a young person in a position of enormous wealth and privilege and celebrity who is living the lifestyle that is expected of them. And then when they live that lifestyle and fulfill everybody's dreams and wish fulfillment and needs of them, then they fucking turn on them.
Right. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
It's a system that is set up to reward this type of behavior. And then the scapegoat becomes the person and not the system.
But the scapegoat specifically is the woman.
Right.
It's the woman's fault. It's not him.
Right.
All right. Never mind. That was a conversational cul-de-sac because you agreed with me. Yes. That was it's plunging take on the film.
It's a good take. I think what you said prior to that, I was bristling a little bit. I'm sure that you sensed it.
Like, I wasn't really paying attention to you.
Well, like, you were saying that it goes to great lengths to humanize this person because she's just doing what's expected of her at the time or whatever. And the thing that you weren't saying is like, it's a fucked system that deserved to be torn down.
Sure. But it's not her fault is the thing.
No, it's not.
Even like the historical depiction of Marie Antoinette is like starts and ends with Let Them Eat Cake.
Right.
With her like privileged, wealthy indifference to the struggles of the masses.
Correct.
Yeah, the system and the baroqueness and the decadence of all of it is the problem unto itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure. It but deserves to be burned down, but she didn't deserve it.
The scapegoat does not need to be the woman.
Yeah, she was just fucking trying.
Yep.
And this was a Tani observation, but like, yeah, and then she has a daughter and they're like, oh yeah, you can have the daughter. You can have the child. And she gets like a few seemingly like blissful years of like raising her child in like, you know, bucolic wonder and splendor removed from Versailles. And they both get to be people for a little while. Until the craziness needs to come after her, because then she has a son and now she has to fucking come back and live in the insanity palace with all the crazy people.
Can we just, from now until in eternity, call Versailles the insanity palace?
Sure. Sounds great.
I think that that's good.
Oh, you were talking about the emotional journey. And I think Kirsten is amazing and I do not fault her for this, but I think a fault with the film, and I don't know if it's like a thing in the edit where they just cut out some scenes that I might have felt were necessary, or if it's a screenplay thing or something else. But I do feel that in the elastic and the accelerating nature of time, I feel like there's a scene that's missing where we go from...
from her having an affair to her standing by her man?
Well, not even just the affair, but like the affair and the children and then the loss of a child and then... Your Highness, the peasants are coming and we must leave. And he says, no, I will stay here. And she says, well, my place is by the king, so I will stay here as well while the fucking palace is burned down. And I just don't see where that comes from for her. Like, I feel like that is something that's missing. And I don't know, maybe on repeat viewings, I'll be able to forgive that. But
I kind of disagree. I feel the affection between her and Louis, her and Schwartzman.
Yeah. He's just Jason Schwartzman in the movie.
Jason Schwartzman, yes.
Not to fault him. That's why you cast him.
Right.
You don't cast him to submerge himself in the role.
No, you don't want Jason Schwartzman to meld into the background and become Louis the 16th.
Yeah.
But there, like, genuine affection happens between the two of them. That's the through line that you get to... genuine affection from her for now her country.
I never felt anything like that affection for the country because the movie is so walled off and so hermetically sealed from the country. Like she leaves Versailles one time in the entire movie when they sneak off to that party.
Right. But they do talk about it a bunch and there's a lot of back and forth between like her responsibilities to Austria versus her responsibilities to France. You know, her brother remarks that I can't very well steal the Queen of France away. And I feel like she both grows into being Schwartzman's wife as well as into being the Queen of France. And maybe there is a scene that makes that transition better, but for me, I was sold.
Yeah. I'm not with you on buying any affection for her, for the country, because the country is just not depicted at all. Like Versailles is depicted and the wealth and
no, it's talked about is what I'm saying.
But even then, it's what she's talking about with her brother and her divided loyalties is not between Austria and France. It's between her family, her birth family in Austria and her loyalty to Versailles.
Well, what's the difference in the mindset of a young royal between those things?
Right. But that's not the same thing. Like, I don't feel any loyalty of her to the country. It's just to the husband and just to the lifestyle that she has. Anyway, that's picking nits. That's splitting hairs.
Good movie.
Yeah. Super, super good. Big, big fan.
Yeah. I'd like to watch it again. There's just a lot there. There's a lot on screen.
And the casting is just marvelous. Like, we've gushed about Kirsten and about Schwartzman, and I just love Rip Torn. So much in the movie. He's so much fun. He's so Rip Torn. Rest in peace, Rip Torn. but also like the
Steve Coogan
as the, like, the Austrian advisor who's trying to, like, help her navigate the politics. Steve Coogan plays it basically straight. Really, really good. I love Judy Davis as basically like her, almost like Coogan's counterpart, like the French countess of whatever, who right. is the one who's like, getting her accustomed to life at Versailles. Very funny, like very dryly funny performance. Fucking Rose Byrne, always like one of the best parts of every movie that she's
Which
in.
Which one is Rose Byrne?
Rose Byrne is, I forget all the characters' names because they're all very French and they have, like, you know, French titles as well. She is the young partying countess or duchess or princess or whatever she is, who becomes her best friend. Rose Byrne rules and is so much fun in this movie.
And Molly Shannon for just like a couple of scenes.
God, but that's another bit of like the anachronism of it, that like Molly Shannon is not somebody who you would cast in a French period piece drama about right. Versailles, but Molly Shannon paired with fucking Moaning Myrtle, Shirley Henderson, that like that perfect constant passive aggressive bitchiness from the two of them. Yep. Is such perfect flavor and tells you everything you need to know just by their presences. And then they open their mouths and it's even better. The two of them are great. And then Jamie Dornan, who like, I don't normally like it. I think he's pretty dry, but he plays he's not a Welshman. He's the gentleman that she has an affair with. He's terrific. And
their chemistry is great too.
Their chemistry is great. I mean, Jamie Dornan is good at smoldering. I do prefer him when he's singing and dancing on a beach like he does in Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar.
Yes.
But he smolders extremely well. And Kirsten smolders right back at him and is wonderful.
People were complaining about the music.
That is my recollection at the time, that like the anachronism annoyed a certain subset of the audience, is stupid.
Did that subset ever see A Knight's Tale? 5 years prior,
people complained about that as well.
That's a dumb argument.
But also, like, just like, but like everything is an anachronism. Also, like, oh, it should be like real life. Well, then they should all be speaking French,
right?
And also, there should be no music because there's no 90-piece orchestras following the characters around. And also, there can't be edits because edits violate rules of like spatial and temporal continuity. Get over yourself. It's a movie. It's a construct. But some people just got to complain.
They do.
It just all has to be real and natural, or what we have been trained for real and natural to be.
Right.
But if the movie was actually French, people wouldn't have gone to see it.
No, because we can't read subtitles.
Well, you just can't read in general.
F*** you, but man.
Other people can't be bothered to read subtitles. It's true.
God damn it.
Jameis.
Yes.
Jameis' son. Do you think this movie pairs well with the wine? Not with the food.
Because
the food was all very Italian.
Yes.
But with the wine.
I do.
You've already said this, and I still disagree with you.
Yeah. No, I think the warmth of this movie, the lived-in feel that you were talking about, but also the fact that it's still very French in its aesthetic, that sort of like rigid style that the French have, I find very much in this wine.
Because this wine is Burgundian.
Yes. And this wine feels very like straight-backed, and it has that defined structure to it while still being bright and friendly and inviting. So yes, I think that this wine pairs quite well with this movie.
Yeah. I'm just not feeling it. I am a little distracted by the tannin, admittedly.
And you're a little bit distracted generally today.
Shut up. This is just so, and again, as I said last week, I am trying to broaden my own movie wine pairing conceptions to not be about parallels or overlap or shared notes between the things, but like I'm trying to be a little bit more conceptual, less so with this pairing. Like we should talk about it. The things that you said about this wine.
Yes, I said that it was friendly, that it is warm, inviting, but also showing baking spices invoking warmth. Historic, uses historic reference in winemaking, also an historic estate in this place. Velvety or plush and floral roses.
So I think I nailed all the pairing words with this selection. And I guess I can see all of those things in this wine. And yet. Yeah, the literal in terms of the vocabulary used. I think your words are a very good description of this wine. Mm-hmm. And your words are a very good description of this movie. But there is something ephemeral between the movie and the wine that I do not agree pairs well.
I think it works. I think Pinot Noir is a really good choice for this movie. A white wine might have an abrasive sharpness that I wouldn't want with this movie.
I find this abrasive. Not sharp, but it is abrasive.
I think it has tannin, but I think that you're just being overly sensitive about the finish there.
Super taster, Jamie.
You're not a super taster. You absolutely are not a super taster.
Super taster.
You're definitely not that.
Super tasting some super Tuscans, okay?
This is not a super Tuscan.
I wasn't listening when you were talking. I was looking for t-shirts.
This is a wine from Patagonia.
And that's in Argentina.
That's correct.
But why the fuck were you talking about super Tuscans before?
Because the person who purchased this estate and built the winery
is a super Tuscan.
Is the son of the person who started Sasakaya.
Johnny Words is going to love this part because I'm now asking you to explain something that you explained 45 minutes ago.
Fucking.
Oh, hang on. I'm getting a text from Johnny Words right now. Apparently he's listening to this episode live. Words.
So yeah, I think that this goes really well. I see your problem, and I think it's mostly like a little bit of a fixation on the tannin. Not to call you out for being hyper fixated on one element.
Because I'm a super taster. Well, but it's not just the tannin, like, but it's also the color. It's also the, again, trying to allow for contrapuntal things, but like the color and the darkness and the boldness of the flavors of this is so at odds with the movie. And I don't find that, like you were talking about in our last one, that apparently it's a pro or it's a feature in pairings when they change one another.
Yes.
And I don't know that this would change the experience of watching Marie Antoinette. I did not open the bottle when I watched the movie the other night. I don't know that this would change the experience of watching it or if the movie would change the experience of this. But just like conceptually, just drinking it, I'm not feeling... I just feel that it's too far away from what the movie is. Like, yeah, there's the florality and the what you call a velvety texture that matches up to like the sense of texture that you get from the fabric and the wardrobe and the plushness of all the upholstery. I get all of that. But then the darkness and the boldness and the tannin and the color is so at odds with my experience of the movie, just of looking at it and listening to it, that I'm not finding that to be working.
Fair enough. Well, one vote for, one vote against. I think we're going to need a recount, and we're going to have to litigate this election in the Supreme Court.
I was going to say we could just recount it right now because it doesn't take that long to count to two. But then you had to go and...
Then I did that thing. Yep.
Yeah. Just vote, everybody. That's the solution. Listen to Nancy and Joe, okay? Just vote. Everybody just vote, and that's going to solve all of our problems. I can let them eat cake. Burn the motherfucker down. Let's start over. All right. Well, so hang on. Let me see if we can keep track for this miniseries, because I forced you to keep track last time, or I attempted to keep track last time. I don't remember. Did we say that last time was a successful pairing? I felt like I was a little ambivalent.
We were both a little bit ambivalent. Yeah, me leaning a little bit more towards yes, and you leaning a little bit more towards no.
I think I clocked it at a 6 out of 10 pairing success. Both things very good, fine together. And I would say with this, you seem to be very strongly in favor of the pairing, and I'm pretty against. So let's say a 5 out of 10.
Sure.
So now we're 11 out of 20 for the miniseries. That'll be the new metric by which we maybe keep track of these things.
The points don't matter. None of it's real. It's all fake.
Well, if you are keeping score at home, we're not done yet after today. Jamie, where does your Philadelphia tasting menu take us to next time?
It takes us to the lower end of East Passyunk Avenue to a little restaurant called Le Vertu.
Mm.
It's an Abruzzese restaurant run by Kathy Lee and Francis Cretarola. I talked with them a little bit, and they decided on their tacozzelli alla pescolana dish, which is a like torn handkerchief type pasta served with Abruzzese sausage, truffle paste, and saffron. So this is going to be a pretty boldly flavored dish. And I have paired the Podericola Nebbiolo di Alba 2019, which is available at Crush Wine Company for $24.
I have questions about almost every noun that you said in your description of the restaurant and the food, except for sausage and pasta. I do question handkerchief, but we'll get to that next time. Well, Jamie, you told me that wine was rough, dark, mushroomy, high contrast, meaning bright fruit against dank earthiness, and traditional. And I, to all of those words, for puntal and contrapuntal reasons, paired a little film from 2016 by a French filmmaker named Julia Ducournau called Raw. As of this episode's recording, it is available to watch on the Netflix. I highly encourage everyone to do so. I will give you content warnings. This is one of the most intense movies that I have ever seen in my life. But specific content warnings, there is graphic depictions of violence, of consumption of raw foods. There are depictions of non-consent, and it is gnarly and it is upsetting. And even though the actual things that are on screen are not so graphic and provocative, that the way that they are depicted, the visceral, sensual quality of their depiction is very strong and can be very repulsive. So if you don't have a strong stomach and a strong fortitude about things like horror movies or body horror or graphic depictions of anything, this might not be the movie for you. That said, if you think you can handle it, this is a wild fucking ride, and I highly encourage that you check this one out.
No comment on that until next time from me.
Wonderful. Raw, Julia Ducournau, 2016, hopefully still on Netflix by the time this episode comes out. Check it out, y'all.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod, and if you have comments, questions, or concerns, go ahead and email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're a listener outside the United States and you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, go ahead and email us that review so that we can read it on air. We only see the domestic reviews. Also, don't forget to tell your friends.
And tell us what Marvel movie you want Jamie to watch.
No.
Or just fucking...
No, no more. I don't
want
to.
Or I don't know. Maybe you really want.
I don't
want,
like it.
Maybe you really want Jamie to watch the ultimate director's cut of Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. I would allow that as well.
This is quickly turning into just like a make Jamie watch bad movies.
No, it has to be. I'll make allowances within the superhero genre.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Especially if it's the really bad one.
Can someone pick Mystery Men? I really enjoyed that one back
in
the
sorry,
day.
I'm sorry, that's not allowed. That's not from one of the big two publishers. I don't think that's canonically acceptable.
F- you.
This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin.
That's me.
And our art is thanks to Ross Connard. Thank you very much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise. This is just a reminder, everyone, to sometimes stop and smell the roses, both literally and metaphorically.
Figuratively.
Metaphorically works. Don't fucking correct me.
But if you want to like parse the phrase, it's literally or figuratively.
I didn't want to. I said what I said, and okay. I meant what I said.
Literally, and like it's a spectrum.
I understand.
You put the or in there. Literal and figurative are opposites. Literal and metaphorical are
not opposites?
No.
Is something figurative not possibly a metaphor?
A metaphor is usually figurative, but in this case, your metaphor
you're picking
is
a nit that
literal.
Doesn't need to be picked.
Man, I'm just glad I was able to focus on one thing for 5 seconds, okay?
Scott not having his meds is really...
Oh, it's such a problem.
It's a big problem.
Oh, man. This is just what all of middle, high school, and college was like.
I remember.
Wasn't great.
No. No, it wasn't.